And welcome to Tales from the Pit, the behind the lens access to the entertainment world and the creative people involved. Today, we're talking with Bobby Phillips. He's done a lot of different jobs with a lot of different acts. He's been out with Grayson Chance, Asking Alexandria. He's currently out with Gwar. Bobby, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. And you kind of coming in last minute. We have a lot of people that have shifting schedules. So thank you so much for being last minute on this. But we'd like to start off with maybe a little bit of history, if you don't mind. Maybe talk about your younger days. Was, you know, you're currently tour manager with Gwar. Was that something you were always interested in doing? Was it a music thing that you just worked your way through? But tell me about your younger days. How did you get in your path?
This was not planned. As most people in this industry and then up on this side, but it started. I was playing a bunch of musical instruments when I was in, you know, middle school, high school. Ended up with an electric guitar and realized that I preferred to write my own music and play with people versus being told, like, be part of this big thing but play just these notes to make a whole. And I was like, I'm not as into the orchestral or even like doing the jazz like I was doing and stuff. So I found rock and roll, which led to playing in a Warped Tour era kind of band for a while with my brother and a few other people. And then the singer had a child. So another known story, it was kind of just like, okay, well, we like this industry. I had started running sound when I was about 15 because I did not like that I couldn't hear myself on stage. So I was like, what, how does this, how, why can't I hear myself? And the guy's like, well, you want to try it? And I was like, sure. So then the next thing I know, I'm running three venues with this guy and running sound far more often than I'm playing in the band. And it kept kind of just rolling and doing a lot of house gigs. And my brother and I started a facility called Electroganic that had screen printing and a recording studio and backline company and rehearsal spaces, a whole bunch of stuff in Norfolk, Virginia. And that kind of just kept snowballing until COVID. And we had to shut down the warehouse because of that, which was fine. We were, it was kind of getting to the place in Norfolk where they didn't need a place like us anymore. A lot of people had split off into their own little storage units or buying houses in our 30s. So I focused more on touring again. And I've just been TMing since COVID and running sound for a bunch of bands.
Nice.
So that's kind of how I got here.
Very DIY background. I mean, that's probably the pretty standard for a lot of people I've been talking with lately.
Just yeah,
go ahead.
I went to college. That's actually a funny story too. I went to Old Dominion University and the degree was actually an interdisciplinary study for music business. And at that point I was already working in all the venues. So I'm coming in tired and the teachers were like, what are you doing, man? And I was like, I'm doing all this and I'm playing in the band. And the advisor, when I went to set up for year three, a year and a half in, he was like, hey man, I'm going to suggest you drop out. And I was mad. I was like, what the hell do you mean? Like, my parents told me I got to go to college, all this stuff. And he was like, dude, where you're at right now is where this program is kind of meant to get people to understand they can go to. He's like, you're just wasting your money. So I was like, all right. And he was kind of left it at that. And he's like, I'll be in touch though. And I was like, about what? He's like, can't talk about it just yet. So I got all the paperwork done, dropped out, and he called me back and said, would you be interested in helping making this into a real degree? And can we give you interns? So I was like, what? Sure. So I had an intern every semester that was graduating with my brother, but learning from my brother as well, because he went to the same school. And my brother's class was the first available class to get that degree. So my brother actually graduated with the degree that I helped kind of like turn into a real degree not realizing what was going on, being told I'm not supposed to be in college and thinking it was a bad thing.
That's crazy. That's awesome. Totally unexpected too. That's very, very cool.
Yeah.
Is that program still, is that still going on currently?
Yeah. They've had a couple of different professors since I was there. One guy, Bobby Wright, was there for a long time at Old Dominion and was really helpful to my brother and me. And I think he's at Hampton University now, or he may have retired at this point, but he actually went from school to school and actually helped get budgets and put like real equipment in for, like, when I went, there was like little inboxes and Pro Tools and like the classes, you're kind of like, what the hell is this? You know, but it was good for people that had no idea, but like live sound class I went to, and they're like, you want to just come in and teach one day and then we'll call this an A. And I was like, yeah, that's cool. So, it was interesting for that, but yeah, they have people that are still graduating. I don't do the internship anymore. I moved from Norfolk to Richmond. I stopped doing that, but I'm sure there's a bunch of other stuff that cool that's going on in Norfolk that I think hopefully they're utilizing the community to keep that program actually useful and teaching kids what to look for to be in this business, not just, here's a course book and not doing the networking. That seemed like when it was actually useful is teaching that networking.
That's pretty awesome. Did you have to like do any like research on how to work on that stuff, or did you just kind of do what you know how to do?
In what regards?
In regards to the helping with the school.
They just kind of talked to me about things and like, you know, what actually have you found helpful? And I was like, actually going and finding a venue and learning what happens when a power amp comes undone and shocking the shit out of yourself the first time. And then realizing like, oh, that's not great. You know, like things like that, or talking to people. Like I always did say too, if you've been in this business and you've not been like really fucked ever, thought your life is over at least twice, which the older I get, I realize it's a lot more than that. You're really not in this business. So like teaching people what to look out for with that, or understand how to work with great hands or great staff or union houses, or what the difference between like loading into a non-union house versus a union house means for the roles and the way you go about those things, like all that kind of stuff, like is far more useful for knowing right off the gate than running into a situation where you touch a case and now you got a stagehand in your face screaming at you, you know, which I get, it's their job, you know, I'm glad they're there, but you know, some people don't know these rules and realize that you guys have made a whole union to be those people to help us, you know, like if they don't know, they don't know, but like it is something where we don't want to ever upset those people. We're glad they're there, but you know, that's just a great example of getting steamrolled. It just happens so often, but then also like not doing contracts correctly and not getting paid. And like a lot of young people were working for rates that are far beneath what they should be too. And like, it's just not knowing like they're someone's talking them into doing something for X amount, and they're thinking some more money they made before at another job, but they're not realizing like they could have looked and got a better rate, which now that band's going to be like, well, this guy did it for this. You know, we're always doing this negotiation battle back up to actually. Right.
Jeez, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I want to talk more about a lot of that stuff, but let's tell me more about how you went from just kind of being the musician to being behind the board and stuff like that. How did you get on? How'd you get like start becoming a front of house or a monitor mixer or anything like that?
It was like I said, that I was mad I couldn't hear myself on stage and talk to this guy John, and then he just took a liking to me, and it turned into me working a couple times a week to all of a sudden there's three rooms that both of us are doing. But it was I liked it. I think really this has been a joke, but it's serious. Like I realized like I can make it sound the way that it should, at least to me and the band that I'm working with, to like sonically take what I know and put it out there to the audience. But like, even when I was doing like five band hardcore shows, like being able to dial in a mix quickly, get it done, knock it out, and then make it sound great regardless of the situation. I was working on this is before digital was even a thing. You know, I've been doing it 20 years this year. And it was, I think it really made sense to me when my dad's an elevator mechanic. Elevators are not much different than a soundboard. He taught me how to fix the things when I was like five. So it's all signal flow, right? You push the button that goes through whatever solenoids or electrical boards it needs to get to the point to say, I want this elevator to either leave the floor I'm on or so-and-so, and splitting the signal out. And I played trombone for all of high school. So I was one of those fortunate people where I am now, to where I didn't have buttons or valves. I had a slide and I had to figure out the notes. So I really learned keys and just frequencies in general from having that whole slide. So when I realized those two went together pretty well, this knob and this knob accentuates here and these frequencies in there, and like, oh, this, you know, this fader can operate in two different ways, either go to these places or that place and all this kind of stuff. It just made sense. And I sonically much more enjoyed, again, I think it almost full circle from the orchestra of being a part of that to orchestrating that to work with these people as like another member of a band sonically, and not just recreate what they do on a record, but do a live experience that, you know, we have the ability to add extra effects or really layer it there, or learn that band in a way that you know what you need to pull in or take out of for that specific room, and looking at the physics of it all and realizing you have a left and right speaker set, but really you have left, right, you have subs, you have front fills, you got balcony fills, you got hearing assist, and like realizing this puzzle is infinite of making sure that people, when they spend their money, and they're spending a lot of it now to come out and see us, have the best sonic experience that they can in every way possible, is just driven me down a deep, deep hole.
And you're in a lot of very bizarre different rooms you've never been in. So you have to really kind of factor that in every day as you're going through that stuff too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I have a couple songs that I use, that when I first walk in a room, I work with the house engineer, and I'm always like, look, man, you know the room, I know the band. I don't really have an ego mixing. Like, I just want to have a great show. So it's like, if you want to tell me something sucks, great. Like, because you know, when this room is empty, if a certain frequency is jumping out that you think is going to go away, or the subs build up a lot of energy in the middle of the room. So make sure when you're listening to things, don't account for that, but also account for the fact that it's not really hitting somewhere else. And then being able to take that and take what you know, your core mix, especially with digital boards now. Like, I have a lot of the bands I work with have like a wave system that I bring, that I started off in like a studio. If I can get multi-tracks and get my sources as close as I can to what I want, and then I use whatever console I want as like a corrective EQ, or like really working for the room for me. So that way I'm not rebuilding shit every single night. I'm able to really focus on, all right, I know this mix is going to sound good if I make the system sound good. And that it's a big thing that a lot of people don't think of when they go into a place. They think like someone's just turning up a fader, and it's like, well, just turn that fader a little bit. It's like, that's not really how that works. You know, and I think that's a big thing for people to really account for and think of too, is know a couple of tunes that you know, like the back of your hand. I've been using this song Honey Badger by a guy named Eprog for probably close to 10 years since I was with, I used to be front of house for Noah Cyrus, Miley's little sister. Oh, yeah. And that was interesting because that was like really when I kind of broke into this level of touring, to where like it was no longer a secondary job trying to get into it, but like now this is all I've done. It's a tune that, from what I was told, was made for function one, and it hits the frequency spectrum from 200 to 20,000 hertz. And I used to just go to sleep listening to that song, but it really does isolate just certain frequencies. And this guy was smart. He's whoever created it. This guy Evans was very smart, because he hit in the beginning 30, 45 seconds are the six or seven frequencies that are like notorious for just fucking you up in a small space. And I can hear it, and I know the track so well. I know how loud that those frequencies and those notes he's playing are supposed to be. And if it's off, then I can make my corrections pretty quickly from that. And then I use Don't Stand So Close to Me by The Police. And mm-hmm. usually people are like, why are you doing that? It's like, it's not as sonically pleasing as certain things now that a lot of people like to put on this perfect music, but like the snare in it is just so bad. And like certain frequencies, because I think they were just on so much cocaine, they just thought it was great and printed it, and there's no fixing it afterwards. And it's got like this 400 hertz and like this 8 and like a 2K frequency that can really bounce out of a PA if you're listening for it. And I use those two. I usually can tune a room or tone. I mean, usually I go with whatever system tuning. I don't break into that as much as I just like task them to turn off half brass if we're going into the front of house console. But that lets me tone the room to what I want pretty quickly. And it's made my life a lot easier But also, it's just really funny where you see this whole room of people like being like, what the hell is he listening to? But it's not because I like them. It's because like they just get me to where I need to be really fast.
Yep. Yeah. So people going to a Gore show, opening up with the Police and Honey Badger. And
stuff yeah. Well, that's just when the venue staff's there. Now,
Yeah.
Gar's playlist. Actually, I'm going to just send you this because we've been working pretty hard on it for a while. And yeah, so
while you're doing that, so you're getting ready to, I think you said you're in rehearsals now for Gore, getting ready to hit the road with Gore next week, right?
Yeah. I just finished the tour with Joey Valance and Bray. We finished on the 14th was the last show. And me and Beth, my adult girlfriend, as she likes to joke and say she is still, we drove back the RV, got back the morning of the 19th at like 4 a.m. And then I was at Gore's rehearsal space at 11:30 to get their rehearsals going. So
good Lord.
It's a funny existence going from one band to the next for sure. And Joey Valance and Bray were great. They were a little, I had no idea who they were. They apparently got famous on TikTok, which I know nothing about, shows my age, but it's like Beastie Boys and Wu-Tang, and the two of them, and they self-produce everything, and they have a DJ on stage, and they just go hard. Like, I would recommend everybody see them. The whole tour is sold out. Like, they've been around for 2 years. Like, they had a TikTok that got big, and then one of their moms wrote to Ellen, and then Ellen's like, come on the show. So the first time they performed was on Ellen. It was just like natural for the two of them. And I highly worth checking them out, especially if you like that Beastie Boys styles. But the crowd was crazy. It was like TikTokers and fans of like Beastie Boys that were in like their 30s to 50s. And then for some reason, like 30-year-old to 40-year-old hardcore kids were just super. And it's like mosh pits and all sorts of weird nonsense.
What a bizarre mix of crowd, but actually it's a really cool mix of crowd. That's awesome. That's
fucking
really cool.
Awesome. Like it blew my mind, but it showed that music still, if it's something different than what you and I are used to, with like a lot of these rock bands, it is still alive and people want it. Yep. So
no kidding. So yeah. So you go from, as you just mentioned, a variety of different types of bands. So you're about to hit the road with Gore. You've been with Gore for a couple of years, you said.
Yeah, I started in 2021, so this is year three, I think.
Yep.
2021, 2022. I took over in January of 2022, I think, and the first tour was in March. I was with a guy that goes by Strand of Oaks, which is like if the best way I describe him is if Tom Petty didn't find heroin but acid. That's how that music is. Lovely, emotional.
Yeah,
great, but yeah, I went, and then that's another weird one. I went from that to Gore, and they're unlike anything I have ever dealt with or will ever deal with for the rest of my life, I'm sure.
Yeah, the amount of stuff going on for that band. Can you just talk about you haven't done one yet this year, but can you talk about what a day on the road with them is like for you?
With Gore?
Yeah,
I wake up crying. They know what they want, and they know they've been doing it a certain way to get that result for a long time, even though they know some of it is flawed. So when I came into it, it was I don't want to say it was a fight, but it was kind of a fight for them to see how some of these new processes of a newer school, like, I'm 35. So their other guy was with them 18 years. Yeah. So I was just starting my career really when he was starting with them. So it was just kind of like everything was set. And like, I never got to work with Dave Brocky, but it was still operating like he was in the band, you know, like it was just, when I took the gig, the Mike Bishop called me, was like, hey man, you know what you're walking into, right? Like, you know what you're doing. And I was like, yeah, I got it. And he's like, all right, well, this band operates in chaos and always will. I said, no, it won't. And after like the first year, they were like, there's not as much chaos anymore. So it was just kind of taking and seeing what was really great about a band being able to do this for 40 years and given the opportunity to help them grow. And I'm very loyal and feel very grateful for them trusting me with it and still trusting me with it. But, you know, they're a family that far more than friends, like, you know, families, like, you love them, you're always going to love them. You can tell they all do, but sometimes they can't be around each other. It's just like, you know, your brother or your cousin or anybody you spend a lot of time with. So usually we get home and then everyone just kind of whoop, disappears. Some, not everybody lives in Richmond. I live 15 minutes from the pit and I usually need, after a year of them, like 2 months of just by myself. But I did 220 shows last year too. So when I got home in November, I didn't leave my house.
Yeah. So, for Gwar, there's so much. I mean, they have a very unique, specific show. You have it as Monster Wrangler on your, you know, as your job thing. Yeah. Let's talk about what's involved with getting their show going.
The day of. Sorry, you're bringing up talk about. But so there's a lot in my mind with Gwar, so you're gonna have to steer the conversation a little bit. Day in the life, we're on a bus, so that's great. So we have a driver that takes us everywhere, and I always line it up to where we pretty much pull up about an hour before we're supposed to load in, or earlier if we can. And everyone kind of gets stirring. A lot of my techs work. I have 2 to 3 techs on the tour, depending on which configuration of the show we're taking. But my brother's actually the monitor engineer. And then a guy named Eddie Collins is our backline tech. And he also works for Anthrax as stage right guitar tech. But so the three of us, and then Matt McGuire, he was one of the, he's Sawboard Destructo and like one of the folks that makes all the costumes and all that kind of stuff. We'll usually walk in and kind of look at the room, look at the stage. It's somewhere we've been before. We look and see if there's, we're going with the plan we had last time or if anything needs to change, figure out where we're going to fill our blood tanks, all that kind of stuff. And then I'll go check out like the green room and everything like that, figure out where we're going to put our cases for wardrobe, for where the, usually the monsters for the show are, opposite of Monitor World. And we carve a big amount of space out for all their red cases. And so they're, it's private, so people can't see them change. And then I'll figure out where the band side of the five characters who play the instruments are going to change and get ready. We try to make it pretty close to the stage. A lot of them are on stilts, looking for trip hazards. Is this tall enough to get the costume through? Is this wide enough to get the costume through? Is the space heated? It's amazing. After all these years, I still come in and they're like, oh, we always put them down this back hallway that's like dripping or stuff like that. So we're actually rewriting our rider right now to say like, it needs to have HVAC. I mean, they're in their 50s. So, you know, they get off stage, it's freezing cold and they're sweaty. It's like, that's how I had ended up having no shows like 3 shows later. So we check all that stuff, make sure area is secure. Fans do like to try and get backstage and take props, so I'm always looking for that. So we just kind of get the lay of the land, and then I always have 6 or 8 hands there to help unload the semi truck. So at that point I break away and kind of just start doing the TM thing, checking on the band. Beth, she sends a lunch order to everybody at the restaurant. She gets the text back from everybody, hopefully quickly. Sometimes I got to chase people down, say, hey, did you look at the menu? We feed everybody. We have an app that tells us like bus stock, like stuff the guys like to have on the bus. If something runs out of something, Mike Dirks, ball sack will update the app and I'll see that coming through and know it's almost time to give that to the runner. Usually by then I've discussed with the venue people everything I need to, found my contacts, made it aware of anybody who's freaking out about the fact they're about to have blood sprayed everywhere is calmed down. Make sure we have towels. Towels are very important to these guys. Cause now they do a meet and greet every day too. So during the Mudvayne run, it sucked cause they had to get dressed every day. So they're getting dressed twice. They're grumpy. Wearing this costume sucks. Like anything over like an hour and a half for them is just torture. So like we try to keep them out of them as much as possible. But so they do like a meet and greet, add a costume, say hi to everybody. They get to watch a couple tunes. So by that point, I've gone out front, set up, I use a little Midas for them in a Waze rig. I've made that rig set up to where it sets up in about 5 minutes. So I get up, check on where I'm plugging in for the system. Is it left, right sub, whatever my sends need to be. Listen to my two songs, go do some more TN stuff. Here on the radio, they're ready for sound check. Come up and watch fans talk to them for about 15 minutes and want them to be done with it so we can finish up. Then we'll get them on the stage, do like two or three tunes. If there's something they need to hit, we'll hit it. But I'm generally finished with sound check after like 15 minutes. They all scurry away. We go back to hunting for the towels that somehow people still haven't found. Because it's 72. No one believes we really need 72 towels. But when you have three other support bands, and then these guys all need, you know, two towels or so, get makeup off and then also shower. But like, they're not, you know, like Bishop's not small. You know, he's not a huge man, but like a little, if you give him like a hand towel, it's just like watching a sumo wrestler try to like dry himself off. It's terrible. So like, we just always, and then they always have to be washed. Like a lot of times I get there and they'll be brand new and like they'll be pink or white. And then you'll just have a bunch of guys in their 50s running around with like fuzz all over them and their costumes and they're bitching. So like it's these little things that with this band I've never had to deal with. It's like, here's your rider stuff. Like, fuck off for a while. Call me if you need me. Like these guys with all the maintenance, the costumes and their rigs have gotten a lot easier too. Pustulous just had to step down, so we have a new guy coming in, but he was using a bunch of Marshalls, and like the tech and him were always working on stuff and all these MIDI pedal board loops and things that sounded great when it worked, but it would not always work. And then Dirks has MIDI chaos pads built into his guitar. I just brought that home to fix that. So like we're always fixing shit because like it's not always because it gets sprayed, but like they're always in these costumes, their hands aren't paying attention, so like things get broken really easily. So I'm constantly working on that kind of stuff whenever I have time, when I'm not looking at contracts or advancing the next show. So it's a lot of walking. Like my little Apple fitness thing is always telling me I've hit my goal by about 2 o'clock. So that's great. So then support bands are on. Back to the day. I usually try to sneak away for like an hour nap because at this point I've been up and rolling, and we're always on walkie. So like, I just have it sitting next to my ear. So it's like, just more like closing my eyes and just hoping and like just waiting for the next thing to happen. But it's gotten really good over the last year. Like the crew and everybody, like things aren't breaking as much, like other stuff like that. We're learning, like everyone's in a good mood and keeping things floating. So I can usually at least get the hour to myself. It's funny, the beginning of the last tour, we had a band called Cancer Christ playing with us. And I did not look them up like I should, but you think anybody that tours with Guar, like there's a set of antics, and then there's things that you just should know you shouldn't do, probably, or like at least when you go from like a punk club that has no rules to like a venue like Live Nation, like runs. We were at Wally's Pub, which is independent.
I know Wally's, yeah.
Yeah. So when I first met the Cancer Christ guys, they were like, oh, yeah, so we got a little bit of blood. I was like, that's fine. You know, just don't spray our shit up on the front of the stage. Cool. We tear Bible pages out of the Bible and kind of walk through the crowd. That's fine. If the venue has to clean them up, do it, because I'm not paying the charge. You know, we already pay a charge for the blood, but they will nickel and dime the shit out of us. We start adding a bunch of paper in that.
Of course.
So I was just like, no. And they're like, okay, can we use our flamethrower? And I was like, what? What did you just say? I'm like, yeah, we have a flamethrower. I was like, not at any of these shows. And they're like, so not in the building. I was like, yeah, thinking like that's the end of it, right? Like, I didn't quite catch what he said at the end. So I go, everything's going great. First day of this tour, go to lay down. All of a sudden, my phone is going off the fucking hook. It's the promoter. He's like, hey, man, what's up with the flamethrower? And I was like, what? And like, their set hasn't quite started yet. So I'm just like, what do you mean? And then I get a video and they're out front of Wally's in the street firing off this flamethrower in Catholic priest robes. One of them is the singer and the rest are wearing reptile masks with blood smeared all over them. Now, these guys are all from LA. The singer is not toured. He told me he worked in the video, like the movie industry before that. He is a very, very nice creature, but pushes the boundaries, right? So he's out there spraying this thing and screaming in the middle of conservative New Hampshire when we're at essentially what I believe is a biker bar, you know, and right. And they don't know what to do. So I was like, all right, no more flamethrower. It's like, stop that. They went in and did their set. The Bible verse thing definitely didn't go over well. So they still did that here and there, but it became less and less as I think they realized it was, you can't do it everywhere. So we're in New York after that. I'll just go into this real quick. He's getting joked by the hands for his stutter. He pulls the fire phone and goes, Mom, I want to go home, and throws it down. All of a sudden I got the venue calling me. They just intercepted a call through maintenance to the fire department. Like, if they don't get an answer, the fire, like if you pick that thing up and hang up and it makes it to the fire station, they have to send somebody out. And then if it's a fake call, you got to pay the bill for it. So I got lucky that I didn't have to figure out how to pay however many thousands of dollars for the fire truck to come out, because this maintenance guy who they said is like the dude from the IT crowd. Have you ever seen that show?
Yeah,
like whatever his name is that hides in the server room. That was essentially their version of this guy. That the guy was like, I haven't seen him in 2 years, and here he comes. So having to deal with that. And then I had to have a talk with the guy, and I was like, I need you to learn how to read room. We were with a bunch of people that didn't need to hear that conversation. He's like, I'm really good at that. And I was like, really? And like, look around. I'm like, so we had to establish some ground rules, and he stayed in the green room for the rest of the tour, except for a couple other instances. So there's a lot of days that I have things like that.
Hey, I just want to jump in here real quick and say that if you're enjoying the show, please check us out on all podcast locations and on YouTube. Search for Tales from the Pit podcast. Please remember to like and subscribe. It helps us grow the show. All right, back to the show.
We've had support bands out where the singer had an alcohol problem, and I've had to kind of wrangle him at the end of the night to make sure he was where he was supposed to be and things like that. And so that's not always just specific to Guar. That's shit I have to deal with a bunch of tours. Usually support bands that are newer to the scene and are still thinking it's like Motley Crue times and not realizing like this is not how you can act anymore. So I usually get that crowd in like the first week where I know the band not be there anymore. So after that, if I'm done with all that shit, take my nap, enjoy, you know, I'll sometimes watch some of the opening bands, but I'm really weird about using my ears before I mix just because I'm about to do an hour and a half or whatever. A couple of people go backstage to do a photo with the band. They come back out. We start the show. Usually I have a bunch of plastic out front. They're really good about not hitting me, but they will come very close. It's amazing how accurate those guys are with those blood guns. Like, they have an air compressor on stage that they can dial in and out. And I think they can probably hit up to about 80 feet away if they want, but we usually dial for about 40 or like really they'll dial it in by aiming to like the left or the right of the sound booth. And if it goes past me, then they'll turn it down, but they're always readjusting the pressure. And there's one time in the last tour at the Masquerade, I guess one of the Scott Bryan, he's testicles. So he's the guy that fills the blood tanks. If you ever seen the Guar documentary, he's the guy at the very beginning smoking a cigarette, filling the blood tanks. Probably one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life, and he should have his own TV show. But he tried to hit two people above me, and I was just looking. And they've never hit me at the Masquerade, so I didn't really think about the plastic because they've never tried to hit people in the balcony above me. I don't know what he was thinking, but I just see this arc of blood just coming at me. And I was like, oh, no, you're kidding, right? Like, this isn't real. And it just hoses the front of house console. Like,
oh no,
just a good 3 or 4 seconds of just me getting splattered and me just looking at it like, I guess we're going to test this guy now. And it was fine. It was Midas M32. A lot of people have a bunch of terrible things to say about him, but you know what? It's been blood tested and approved. So,
nice.
So I had to text and I got a bunch of towels and I'm trying to mix while cleaning the board off. So that's one time they got me. They got the back of my wage rack once the lighting guy pulled the plastic and Bishop was standing under a speaker and just he has two dicks that spray. And one is aimed pretty well to hit the crowd and the other one is willy fucking nilly. And he always grabs the one that's easy to control. So he's just standing there not looking. And it is just going into the front of house area. And so Nick, I guess, had pulled the plastic. So the back of my wage rack was just hosed and I couldn't get to it. And as he does this, he sticks the mic into the speaker and my entire system freezes. Console, waves, both computers, everything. And I was just like, great. And he's looking at me going, what the fuck? And like holding the mic in the thing. And I'm like looking at him like, you could stop this right now, you know? And then he moves away and it was about 30 minutes. And of course this is in LA where all the industry people are. And it was about 30 minutes of me just unplugging, plugging stuff in. The waves is still passing audio, thankfully. So I just left that, but every other connection I could, I'm drying out. And finally I got control back in like a half capacity. I thought we were going to have, I thought I was going to need a whole new system. And I dumped, it had to be a pint glass worth of blood out of the back of that rack. And it took me about 2 weeks of, I replaced the part that I thought was like the problem. And then 2 days later, something else, and then something else. And it took about 2 weeks to get it back up running, blew up one of the computers, like things like that. So I would have to take the whole computer apart and take the little watch battery out of the computer and let it sit for 10 minutes to drain and then plug it back in so the clock would reset so I could actually do the show while I was waiting for Amazon to bring me the next computer.
Damn.
B-Link, little like Intel NUC units, they're like $200, runs SuperRack really well, runs a lot of the audio stuff, highly recommended to anybody. But that 2-day shipping when you need a new one and then the fact you're only spending $140 at a time, it's a great little throwaway computer.
Nice.
They got me through the guar run. Like,
wow.
So that
Wally show, was that last year?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I almost went to that Wally show because I'm a local photographer for Live Nation, a bunch of venues and stuff. And I do Wally's occasionally every so often. I was almost going to put in for that show. So I probably would have emailed you back then. But I was going to put in for that show. And then I was like, I don't dare to get my camera just hosed with blood. So I was like, I think I'm just not going to bother with that one.
Yeah. A lot of them bring rain shields that work for a lot of them. I've seen a bunch of cameras go down, man. Like people don't, they're like, oh, it'll be fine. And it's like, if they're in that barricade, you're not safe, you know, like at all.
And you got nowhere to go in there too. You're locked in there.
You're there, especially because of the amount of security we have for crowd surfers and stuff like that. That's another thing I do every day is I have a security meeting with them and I'm like, you know, I try to be funny with it. But I'm like, who here's done guar before? Who here hasn't? All right, you're fucked. And like everyone gets a good laugh and then we talk. And we really do have to make it very clear. Like there's a circus sideshow happening right behind you and you can't turn around and look because as soon as you do, you're going to get kicked in the face or someone's going to drop. So I have to make it very clear to them, like, all you're going to see behind you is a bunch of spraying dicks and they're going to spray you because they also want you to watch the crowd. So we've had a couple where the security wouldn't catch people and stuff. And we've had to go down there and take care of it, you know, and it's embarrassing for the venue. They can't believe these guys are just getting like, they don't want to get sprayed with blood. Like, and we try to make sure they tell the security before they come. But a lot of times we're like, oh no, it's all the new guys. It's like, come on, man. Like, you know, like at least let them know what's happening. Like that guy's wearing white Nikes. Like, you know, like it's funny, but yeah, the blood is that's a large thing that is a big logistical nightmare a lot with us. especially when fly.
Yeah. So moving from Gwar to like Asking Alexandra.
Yeah.
Very, very musical. I mean, obviously not a lot of antics as Gwar, but very musical, very talented musical band. Is it for them, is their sound or is their setup, or is that much different from what you would do for other bands, or is it pretty similar?
So I did take a different approach with them. Like Gwar, the M32s work really well because if you heat the pre's up, they sound like the older desks, like the Heritages and stuff. Like if you know how to make that board sound good, you can get a good sound out of it, but it's got a colored sound. It's definitely, I use it and lean into that for like that 80s kind of like thrashy sound with Gwar that works well. That would not work with Asking. There's right. There's a lot of layers to them. And then Danny's vocal. So I actually tried to get a Allen & Heath D Live for it, but they were just the rental houses did not have them during festival season. So I ended up with an SD9 from Digico, and we did fiber and then did an SD rack versus a D2 rack. Just cause those pre's are very clean. So I wanted more transparency. They're using a lot of churches for that reason of the clarity and everything. And like they're just a well-rounded board that if you're touring with it, you can build it from the ground up. And that level of I was going to do an SD11, which is a small format one, but the processing in it was limited. You can't do as many groups or many channels. So I went to the SD9 that let me use, a bunch of groups to really kind of mix down everything and compress it in certain ways to make everything sonically fit that I don't really have to think about with Gwar. Because that's just straight drums, bass, guitar and vocals. And then some samples for some characters is really not like, Sick of You, I think, has a trash can hit that's in one of the things. But other than that, it's really just like voices. So that I didn't need as much processing for, but with Asking, the drummer's insane. I had, his kit was mic'd up and I had things like gong drums. So I had a bunch of toms that, so I grouped the kicks, kick in and out. He had two kicks. So I had four mics doing that group, two mics on the snare, a mic on all four toms, and then the gong drum. And then hi-hat ride and two overheads. So I had everything kind of bust out into groups that were fed into more groups. And I had processing on each of those in the waves thing. So it was definitely interesting with them because they do have a lot of like tracks that also play with them that are tasteful. It's not like, it's not like overdoing it, but if you don't mix them correctly with what they're actually doing on the stage, it can you lose the nuance of the live show, like the guitars and all that kind of stuff. So it allowed me to really break everything down into different layers of sonically working with each other that I was grateful to have. And then let me process Danny's vocal with a couple of different options. That he's got such a range and a dynamic that I didn't want to lose that, but I also wanted everything to be able to for him to sit on the top of everybody. So it's a highly different way of mixing versus Gwar. And I actually did a festival where Asking open for Gwar on the same stage. I had left another guy that works for me some, he's a Necrogoblicon's front of house guy, Jaska. And he came in and filled in for the end of the Gwar run while I went to Asking because they overlapped. And actually when we got to the festival, Gwar was running late. I had advanced for both of them. I was there anyway. I was going to just take care of both, but my, got a call from our tech Eddie and from Matt saying that my brother was laid out in the front lounge and they didn't know what was wrong. So not only am I trying to dump both trucks with the stage hands and get everything for both bands into a place, and the stage was smaller than they told us. So there wasn't really wing space. There wasn't this or that. So I'm waiting for the bus to get there with my brother with EMTs while I'm getting stage hands to dump pieces of both trucks at the same time. Cause I'm also flipping Guar's costumes into asking semi truck. Cause our truck has to pull away as I'm getting pieces everywhere. So that's sometimes the tour manager, you just have to do shit, you know, like, and when you work for multiple bands, like no one ever has both their bands show up and play a back-to-back time slot. Like that's never been a thing, but I was glad I was there because when we got my brother off the bus, he went to the medic tent and we had done that Mudvayne run for a month and a half. So, I don't think he was drinking enough water and he finally just got hit and they put like 3 bags of saline in him and he slept from like 11 that morning until like 4 or 5 when he finally got up in the medical tent. And I'd gotten both our monitor worlds set up, both our front of houses, been checking on him. And then I got him to go drink a bottle of water and get in bed. And he was out again till midnight. So we were down a guy. So, and he sets up, Eddie, bless him, sets up the drum kit, all the guitars, everything like that. Like the guys do help here and there, but most of the time Eddie's just got it. But then my brother handles all the audio world. So he was down his other guy. We're trying to set up during this festival with everything going on. So I had my console set up in front of each other. So it was interesting. So, and this was maybe the fourth show with Asking I had done. So I went right from Asking to Guar, like went and mixed back to back, which was really cool on the two different setups, and using like a lot of the plugins I use are I have like very specific things that I like and go to. So a lot of those were the same, but there were some differences that I chose to do with Asking that I ended up bringing back to Guar after. But it was interesting to hear what a brand like Digico with still using the same concept of waves, the clarity in that console and just how clean that mix was 4 shows in, and then going to a show file and a console I've been using for 200 plus shows that I've dialed in this mix. And it sounded sonically like a toy, you know, almost, you know, a $3,000 desk versus a however much 40,000-60,000 the other desk is in the stage rack. And just hearing the sonical differences that if I would have just, it was wild. I don't really know how to describe it other than like, goddamn, I really understand like why these consoles are this much money versus these other ones. And it's not that it sounded bad. Like I had people that come up and tell me they'd never heard Guar sound that way, which is always a great compliment. So I was still getting that, but like it was, just hearing that back-to-back difference was something that I'm grateful to know, because then I can use that knowledge later on, be like, well, this is why we need to spend this on this or rent. But
yeah,
no kidding. It still works well.
What's the difference between like the Guar crew and the Asking crew? Is there a different how many people on each team? Do you know?
It's so Guar is a monitor engineer in playback. And then backline tech. If we are carrying a light package in the LD, he also kind of helps. And we have a guy named Nick that's great, but he doesn't make it on every tour. But so the three of them, and then a merch person, and then Scott and Margaret are both. Margaret works in the shop and does wonderful work on the costumes and stuff during the year. But when she tours, her and Scott both take care of like laying down the carpets and getting the blood tanks ready, and then Bob, Matt, and the two of them get their whole world straight. So like some of them double dip as crew and band, I would say. Scott's a crew member, and then we have the merch person. So it's a 5 to 6 man crew for Guar, and this is the lightest they've really ever been from what they've told me. Yeah. So, but we did spend a lot of time, like the monitor rack is just one rack that opens up case lids, and then there's 5 sub snakes that roll out, and then we're done. So we did a lot to make the on and off a lot faster when I came in versus what we had pre-me. They had a budget they needed to redo their ears. So we just went ahead and redid the rig. And then they've gotten really good about policing their own costumes in a way to where we can utilize this. It's either it depends on the venue, but we do six hands on the in and out and four all day. So we always have four people there that are just there to help with the stage. So we couldn't do it without the local hands for sure. But that's a five to six man crew. And asking is, I was the production manager in front of house. We had a drum tech and a guitar tech. And then our tour manager, Steven, he would handle monitors and playback during sound check in the show, but he didn't set up anything. So we had four hands a day for that, four on the in and two on the out. So we would dump the truck. I would set up the monitor world, the guitar tech would handle her world, and then drum tech would handle his world. And we were usually up in about 45 minutes with them. Guar is about 45 minutes to an hour if everything's going right. You know, like we have it, like the drums are on a rolling riser now. So it really is a lot of prep work and looking at it the longer you've been with a band and say, how can we shave a minute? How can we shave 5 minutes? Not like it's just doing those slight tweaks that allow you to run a lighter crew. And luckily with Guar, because we're running a lighter crew, the budgets, they didn't just take that money away. They reallocated it and actually paying correctly. Nice. So it's a good, it works. It's not like would they like another person? Yeah. But we're running 13 deep on a 12 bunk bus right now. So we just don't have, that's why the LD can't always come. We just found a 14 passenger bunk that we got booked for other tours. So he can come back out. But like, until we can afford two tour buses, which is an insane expense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
We have to run that way. Asking would have been cool to have one more tech just because the amount of guitar tech changes they have and all that. But Liz, they have this girl, Liz, that is awesome. So she's handling that. And then I brought in, my buddy Derek, they were looking for a new drum tech, and he was he's run a backline company in Virginia Beach, worked there for a long time. So I asked him if he wanted to take the step up, and he was like, yeah. And he came in and he's killing it. That guy, James, the drummer, breaks so many cymbals. It's like watching a NASCAR stop with Derek. He's got such a rhythm with him that like he knows what James is playing, and when he goes to do a hi-hat part, he'll have that ride switch before James even looks back over. So those two, I'm really glad I called him and gave him that opportunity, because I think he's perfect for that gig. But having people that care like that is a rarity too. I run into so many crew that are just not in it for the right reasons. And, that you could have 10 people like that and have a horrible day, or have two people that want to be there and it's good. But yeah, it's, say a lot of tours are running lighter than they would, but there's not as many amps on stage. Everyone's got Kempers, you know, it's just having people, how many hands do you really need on the stage at once? You know, well, they have a production assistant too. So she'll be on stage and taking care of the guys' needs. Like they need extra waters or shots or stuff like that. She's really good about predicting when Danny's about to say he wants to do a round of shots and already has them. So like that is also very important for a lot of people like that. Like regardless of it's drinking or hydration or towels, or just knowing, having someone that's watching the band all the time and making sure like their little things are taken care of so they can focus on the show is huge. If I could have her out on Guar all the time, I would, but a lot of the time I'm doing all their stuff.
Going back to your like tour manager stuff for maybe specifically right now for Guar, how far at the beginning of a tour production are you involved? I know you're doing rehearsals. Are you involved with like any design, any sort of, obviously are you advancing the shows and stuff like that? What's involved?
Yeah. So with Guar, it is a year round job. It's again, not like anything else. There's so much to that show that we are constantly talking a year, two, 3 years in advance of what the show is going to look like, and how can we make it happen, and how can we budget to make these things happen. But they also do trust me, because I'm really the only one that's seen every show since I've been there. They really trust if I say something didn't work or this or that too. So there's a lot of times where they'll run skits by me and just see what I think, which it's great. It's funny. Like we were talking about, who were you going to kill in Canada? You know, we're doing this next run is mostly Canada. which they haven't been to in a while. So I call it, my buddy Dougal is actually the lighting guy for the Vancouver Canucks. He's hilarious. He tours with me all the time, but I called him. He's like, I cannot believe the questions you asked me. So then he starts like naming off people of like, Canadians think this is funny or they'll think that's funny. So that's year round. We're always talking about like what should be done in the show. And then we've been working so much, like Brent just left the band. He's got family stuff back home. He's focusing more on, and we have a new guy coming in, and he went from the Marshalls to a Kemper. So now we've just eliminated rigs on the stage and put him in the guitar world and all that. So we're always talking about stuff like that, of how to make everyone's lives easier as well. So that's a constant, which I'm really grateful we do all the time. Cause if we waited like any other band and tried to do it all in 2 weeks, someone would get hurt. So, and I'm always talking with management about what our touring schedule looks like and things, and figuring out routings. And if there's this like fly date they want us to do, is it better for us to turn it into a 2 week run or things like that? So I'm involved in a lot of that, of the logistics, and I do all the budgeting. So I've got a template for them now that I've built over the years that I adjust. And so I'm always running budgets for what, if we think it's worth doing things too. So it's that band is not cheap to run at all.
Right.
So everything is very calculated. Like when we fly, like you're looking at $15,000-$30,000 to send all the stuff. If we're shipping everything, like if we got out of Mexico, like we were on the Headbangers boat with Lamb of God and got off to go to Mexico. And then that festival actually kind of fell apart. A bunch of bands pulled out. So we shipped everything down there actually with Asking stuff, because they were playing, and we didn't go because there was some logistics and some other things that made us say we should probably not do this. But like we still had to pay that bill, you know, and shipping everything to Europe. My dad actually built the road case for the blood tanks that we take to Europe. So I have I know the weights of that. I have to figure, we base everything around that. That has to go. We have no show without that.
Yeah,
we have no show without costumes. Like we just pieced together from old costumes, like a B rig of things, where we still have to take some stuff from the A. So like now we have a B set of costumes of older stuff that we think about shipping or leapfrogging things. So like now that, and it's funny, a lot of people didn't realize Guar was still playing. So we're getting a lot of offers from around the world. And now it's like, how do we do this? Like another bit, like Asking, I was just talking to their TM, they're doing South America and Australia back to back. Like they're able to fly everywhere, rent backline equipment, do whatever. That's not a thing with Guar, you know? So it's a logistical nightmare that I don't ever get a break from. So, we're prepping for them all the time. And then I got home at 4 a.m. from this Joey Valance and Bray tour, and I was at the pit at 11 a.m. making sure the new guitar player could hear, like in their little practice room. I moved our show scene from our tour rig to their practice room, and I would go and I'm up there ordering gaff tape and figuring out what else we need, new casters on what, stuff like that. And going in and changing the guys' mixes here and there. And then they're pretty much set until my brother gets there. But so the last 3 days has just literally been me going in. All right, did this actually get ordered? Do we have enough dye for the tanks? We just talked about how much we need to order for the next year to try and get us through. We've been trying to figure out how to know how much we use every day, but it also depends on how thick they want to make it, or if like we need to not make it as thick for certain rooms. Like the cruise ship, we had to send a sample of the dye, and they're like, dilute it, send us another sample. Oh, need you to dilute it more because they're worried about the wood deck. So like we're doing that kind of stuff like 4, 8, 9 months ahead of a show that you don't have to think about, or making sure that wherever they're going to have a stretch, like the booking agent sends me rooms before they even offer any now, because if there's not enough space for them to get dressed, then we can't do a show. So it's either like, do we have a back alley and they're going to go dress in the semi? Are you going to have blower heaters there? Are we going to have 20 amp outlets accessible? Like, so we're talking about all that kind of stuff, like before even tours are being routed, to make sure it's even possible. So that's not like anything I've ever done. I don't ever have to do that with other bands. I don't have to look at the floor plans of a venue that they have to pull from the city because they haven't had to look at it in 30 years, you know, and think about hallways. Yeah. So yeah, that is a special case. Asking, I got that gig. I was filling in for their normal front of house because he was out with Sleep Token. And Steve and the TM usually did the PMing. So he was like, well, do you want to do this? And I'll pay you extra. And I was like, yeah. So we started advancing about 2 weeks out, but I had 2 weeks before that of finding my audio package and the drum tech. So that was about a month, I would say a month out for them of like actually starting to do things. And then it's interesting figuring out like what's actually billable hours or what is like part of your advance rate. So, cause I usually ask for a week of pay for every 4 weeks of tour. So that's like doing the actual advancing and all that kind of stuff. But like, if I got to stop doing that and going and fixing a rig, like am I billing for that? Or is it like, is this really, you know, so it depends on the group with that too. And like how long, Grace and Chance, that only took me like a week. Cause I was just advancing it, everything. We were flying everywhere. It just really depends. I mean, it depends on how well you want it to run, you know. If you're waiting, you know, like I don't like to give more than like 2 weeks. I don't like to send advances more than that because things change. But like if you're waiting till like 4 days before a show to send an email to the venue and then you're mad because your deli tray is not there, like, sorry, you know. So like we try to always give them at least two. If they hit us up earlier because they want a question, we'll answer. But a lot of times I'll be like, this will be answered in the advance and you'll get it 2 weeks before the show. Like there's no reason to talk about this 3 months from now. So I try, there's a fine line of advancing too much or too early. And then, depends on how complex your rigs are, how competent your techs are, you know, like how much time do they really need to get things done, you know, and how much prep work, like with Guar, I'm here, I've lived 15 minutes away. So like, it's easy for me to go in there and just fix something. But, you know, other tours I'm flying into Nashville or LA and it's like, you got to make sure everything's there. So there's not really a great answer to that other than whatever you feel is appropriate for you not to have a heart attack.
Yeah. That's a lot of preparation. I mean, that's so much work. I mean, you're doing so much work covering all with all that stuff when you're not on the road. What are you doing in your downtime to kind of, you know, regroup and sort of reestablish yourself? What do you do in that time period?
I have a lovely house in the suburbs now that we rent while we're trying to find a house to buy. And so generally my honey-do list is about 1 million items long when I get back home. So I usually try to take care of at least some of that. Back in the day when I was younger, it would be going to the bars all the time, but I quit drinking and all that extra stuff. So like I've been rediscovering fun things to do. Like I actually haven't really figured out what my new hobbies are yet. Beth did get me a PlayStation for my birthday. So I've been playing video games, but like I've also been trying not to go too deep into that and get sucked in. So I've been working on a new baritone Telecaster. So I just finished the standing on that. I got to wire it up. And so I'm still playing here. I try to, it sucks because I'm around so much music that when I'm home, it's like, it's podcasts and silence and TV shows. So I have to have enough decompression from whatever other art I'm helping work on to like get to where I feel like I can work on my own art again. So like, I would like to say when I'm home, I'm playing guitar 12 hours a day, but I just can't always bring myself to do that anymore. So I try to do that. And then I have three dogs. So hanging out with them, family, you know, I went a lot of years without really making the effort to see family in my 20s. So I've taken a lot of time to like try to figure out hanging out with them and not overbearing myself with too much emotional and social interaction. So it's a fine line on that too. But yeah, hanging out with them and doing stuff. But I would like to say I would like to go on hikes and things like that, but I'm never home during the summer. You know, generally March to November, I'm gone. This year it's January to November. So it's you're home and you're cold. I live in Virginia. It sucks. So
yeah,
hanging out in the house a lot. But.
Yeah, I'm in Portland, Maine, so I certainly know how you feel. All my summer, I work for Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion, Meadowbrook, and during the summer. And yeah, winter times is just kind of hibernate the best you can. And just kind of, I mean, that's when I do all the podcasting this time of year, because summertime is just crazy. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you said it, you're on pretty much on the road all year this year, but is there any other projects you got coming up that you can talk about or anything like that?
Yeah. So I'm going out with a band called Icon for Hire. So Icon and Joey Valance and Bray, I advance everything for all of them. So even if I'm not on the road with them, I'm still, advancing their shows, and I'm still, putting in all the master tour information. I'm also my own travel agent, so I book all the flights, all the hotels. So I do all that kind of stuff for them too. So I've got a run I'm doing with Icon. Guar's more than likely going to announce more stuff. The Joey Valance and Bray stuff, we just finished that tour, but they're working on new stuff. So all three of them, asking whenever their guy can't do it, I told him I would do it. So I've got them, and I've got, I mean, there's a bunch of bands that I never know, you know. It's like, I'll get a lot, like the Joey Valance and Bray thing came from a manager that used to work in the same offices as their manager and look for somebody. I had no plans on being on the road in January or February, and I got a call December 15th. And I was like, okay. So it's, forgot where we were on that. I was just thinking about, no, I don't see home.
Yeah. You're a busy guy. I totally get it. Yeah. So for, you know, for stuff like, you know, there's people joining the industry and trying to understand how it works, and, you know, they want to jump in. I kind of have a two-part question: is what would you say to people who want to get into the industry? And then also, what do you do to help you prevent from burnout? Cause you got a lot going on and you're going to get overloaded at certain times. How do you deal with that as well? So,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we'll start with like getting into the industry. First off, just a great attitude. Like there's so much in this industry that you will see because people are burnt out or don't realize it's time to step away every now and then, which is important. Like just be willing to learn. Like there's so much information on the internet and stuff like that. That's great. That's where I picked up a lot of the stuff. But like, if I don't learn something new every day, I'm not doing this job right. So everybody out there, regardless of what they do, they could be the janitor in the building. He probably knows something more than you. And, it's worth treating everybody well and just having an open mind to whatever people want to teach you, even if they are annoying. Like if it's someone that is like being a know-it-all, just like, you know, keep an arm's distance, but still listen, because they probably do know something. They just don't understand the social skills that you have to say it in a way that you want to hear it. So, pay attention, you know, be aware of your surroundings all the time. Like this isn't a safe job, you know, it's not a dangerous job either, but like, you do have cases that weigh 400, 800 pounds that are on wheels. You know, they can split a shin real fast. You know, just different things like that. Chains when they're hanging stuff, like be aware, don't walk through people's workspace when they're doing things like that. Like those kind of things are always, people will remember that and don't want to have you back around because, you know, you're all working together as a team. Spend time in your local venues, like get to know people. You know, like I started doing sound because I just talked to the sound guy, you know, and just be friendly. Don't be overbearing, but like, if it's something you want to do, no one's going to hand it to you. There are so many people that want to do this job. They may not like it once they're in it, but there are so many people that want to do this job. You don't stick out. So you have to make it a priority to stick out. Look at how many bands are doing things and how many are way better than what's on the radio or this or that, but they're not doing anything to stick out, you know? So you have to do it tastefully and be aware, but, that'll all go a long way. Anybody that wants to be a front of house guy or a monitor guy, read the manual on every piece of gear that you want to use, you know, like if you don't, know how to get through a menu quickly and know how you like find your workflow on that desk, because every desk has a thousand ways to do something. If you're not quick, you can't really do a house gig. You know, you have to be able to work in that room and how that room's supposed to work. So learn from the people in those venues if you're working with them and stuff, but don't, you know, have the manual in a PDF, command F, you know, find what you're looking for, YouTube, learn that equipment, because a lot of these things are, you know, you're spending thousands of dollars on something that can do a lot of stuff. So make sure you understand what it is so you can be helpful to those people. That's another good thing. Good hygiene. It's you have no idea, especially when you guys start in like vans and stuff like that, like dude wipes, at least, like, you know, stuff like try to be a gracious seatmate, or even buses or planes. Like you have, man, some of the smells makes the whole tour suck. Like, I don't know what else to say about it, but like, you know, like, and it's not always where you're going to have a shower. Like there's going to be nights that there's not a shower in the venue, or you're just tired, you know, but try to make that effort. Cause you'll feel better, you know. I'm sober. I would say a lot of crew people get into it and party, and that's great to do here and there, but you're there to work, you know? So do the job first. And then if you have an issue with a substance, reach out, because this life will kill you. You're never home. You're never anywhere. You feel comfortable. Your mental state is a big thing to take care of. We used to not be able to talk about that in 20 years ago. And it's gotten okay to talk about it, because we live in a very weird place. So take care of your mental health and substances. Keep a good eye on those. Like I said, I had my fun. I would not trade it. I would not change anything about it, but I had to stop just because I care about this job and I care about the people around me. So take care of yourself physically, try to eat well. And a therapist is never a bad thing. Mine will tell you that. So that kind of leads into burnout. If you've been in it a while, you know, but BetterHelp and all those things, like there's good people on there. You may go through a couple, but finding a good therapist you can talk to about what's going on in your life is immensely important. I would highly recommend it to everybody, but especially like with me, like I spend a lot of time with him talking about the things with the bands, not necessarily my home life, but like just getting stuff off the chest and then being able to see it from the outside perspective and help me with different ways of handling stuff if I need. So that has helped with burnout a lot. Getting sober helped with burnout a lot, because like I think I was living in a perpetual years of get up, do the job, get done, go drink, you know, find something to keep you up, keep going. It was like that in my 20s. And during COVID, I realized it wasn't sustainable. So keeping yourself off of that kind of stuff, because if you're doing that shit a lot, you're running from something. So find out what it is, because not only was I running from everything at home by touring all the time, I was also running from what was going on at home or on the tour with booze. So if you catch yourself starting to want that kind of stuff, think about, is it time to take a break? Because if you like being in this business, it's going to eat you regardless. Like you're going to have rough days. And my job is to be fine all the time. So I'm always calm and fine. The few that know me really well know when something's up, but you can't hold all that in all the time. You have to be able to talk about it, or and don't do it, you know, don't overload the crew, like have somebody outside of it, you know, spend the time with your family. But, you know, try not to stay in a venue the whole day either. Like, you know, if you're just around loud noises all the time, you're wearing away your ears. You got in it because you love music, you know, wear earplugs, do whatever. If you're a front of house guy, like my theory on it is if I have to wear earplugs, I'm doing something wrong. So if I wear them in other people's sets, because I want my ears right for my set, but like I also think people need to learn more about sound pressure level and like what, how long you can stay in that. I actually had a really good conversation with the guy from Sinsophonics. He's part of the WHO and they're doing a big initiative in the venues to try and explain the difference between like listening at 100 dB versus 105, which that doesn't seem like a big number, but it, the way SPL works, like you're cutting the time you can spend in music from 45 minutes without a break to 20 minutes without a break real fast. So, right. Yeah. The having your ears ringing all the time and stuff is going to drive you nuts and that'll make you question why you're there. So it's rough. And I'm the worst one to say this because I get from tour to tour to tour, but try to take breaks, you know, but I haven't really met many that can just keep going like I do, but right around the 9 month mark is my, like, I need to be away from everybody. So it's a, know the signs of your brain. And if you don't know them yet, cause you're learning, you know, again, therapy, like things that can help you identify that stuff. Because this is an industry that will take advantage of you over and over and over again, if you're not aware, and you can't be aware of that if you're not aware of yourself.
Right. Right. Great advice. I really appreciate that. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, we've covered a lot. I can't thank you enough for jumping in here. Do you have any socials you want to share? Where do people go find you? Are you active on any of that stuff?
Yeah. I'm not as active on like Instagram as I should be. But it's at Bobbert Grizz. So it's like Robert, just with a B at the beginning. That's mostly the only place I post stuff, but, and then I have a website that's electroorganic.org. I don't really do much with that anymore. Cause like it's, you can contact me through there if you're looking for somebody, but otherwise like Instagram's easier to get a hold of me, or, my email is Bobbert@electroorganic.org. I can send that over too. But, yeah, most of the time I'm just kind of living life actually there. And, I don't do the socials as much as I should, but things get popped up there. There's a good picture of Ballsack and a dog and other stuff, so it's usually related to touring or dogs.
Nice. Well, man, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for watching this episode with Bobby Phillips. We hope you enjoyed it. You can check out our other episodes and our other guests on all your favorite podcast locations and on YouTube. Just search for Tales from the Pit podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode and we'll see you on the next one. This episode was edited and produced by me, Jason Levasseur.